Our speaker today is Dick Whitehead, who is the resident project representative of Wiley Wilson, an employee-owned engineering firm in Lynchburg. He is a geologist by trade and has been working with both Wiley Wilson in Lynchburg as well as many years with North American Exploration in Charlottesville and in Kaysville, Utah. He was a teenage boy when his father was the sheriff, and his father for a teenage boy who went around with his dad trying to find the missing, the lost, the deceased, etc. Since then, since 2005, he's been an active student of the weather event and the geologic conditions that caused the massive number of landslides that contributed to the devastation and the loss of life. He'd been elected to the board of the Nelson County Historical Society and has helped develop numerous exhibits, coordinate and present numerous programs, and co-edited a new book, which he has available here if anybody's interested, the proceeds of which would go to the Nelson County Historical Society. He has led and co-led a number of field trips through Nelson to view the 50-year-old scars and to see the healing that has happened, still happening today. He's had a number of his photographs, some of which are in the book, used by the Washington Post and the Daily Progress, and which did a really nice job article about it back at the 50-year anniversary of the event back in August. And they've also been used by the Times-Dispatch. And so, Dick Whitehead.
Some mighty kind words there. I hope I can keep you entertained here today with some things that we'll talk about. Let's just start with kind of where I get my energy and where I get, who I really represent here, and that is the Nelson County Historical Society. And we have been very active even before I became involved. I would go with my father to help start an exhibit about Camille and gather data and interpret data, and he helped me get started. Unfortunately, I lost him in 2005, so they kind of stuck me, with some Velcro, and I didn't get to leave. They kind of kept me around, and I've since met a lot of the people that my father had interviewed. And I've met a lot of people that have shared information with me that they they developed, and I'm actually going to be sharing with some of their data with you today. It's a collaborative effort. I've helped them with some things, and they've, of course, helped me with some things. A couple of those people are Jeff Halverson, and he is the guru that is really – there are several people that have studied the storm and the meteorology of what happened during Camille, but Jeff has come to Nelson a number of times and given presentations, and his work is kind of cutting edge as to what why we had that much rain. And the other person that I've been working with a lot lately is Ann Witt, and she's with the Department of Geology and Mineral Resources right here in town. Their office is out at Fontaine, and David Spears is our state geologist over there. And they've been struggling with resources of recent years, but I think what Ann is working on as a study of landslides along the Blue Ridge is quite critical data, and I hope that she's able to keep on having funding for that. But I owe a lot of work, a lot of knowledge to what she shared with me as well. So other people would be the Historical Society, and I've gotten a lot of pictures from VDOT and the National Weather Service guy down in Blacksburg has helped me a lot. And, of course, just talking to the survivors of Camille, you learn an awful lot just talking to people. This is not new to anybody. This is the track of the storm. We've got an event down here around the 14th of August, land here about the 17th, dying out up here early on the 19th, and then everything breaks loose here. Interesting enough, when this thing went back out to sea, it was upgraded back up to a tropical depression, so it gained energy as it crossed the Blue Ridge. This is a slide to just show you the intensity of rainfall here and then nothing, and then all of a sudden here. And that's why we had a forecast of scattered showers, an inch or two of rain. So this is a close-up of that same map, and what happens here, you'll see the spine of the Blue Ridge is here, and this is the intensity of rain that happened here. Notice the track of the low pressure, the center of the circulation is to the south of the area of intense rain. And this band here, if you, I'll show you later how many, you know, an hour is about that wide. So this is a 5-hour window. That's about how long we had intense rain. And notice that this line up here is pretty straight. And somewhere up in that area is a cold front boundary, which basically what that did is it kept this from moving south, kept this from moving south or north, because this stayed stationary and this kept everything packed up against it. So somewhere in here we had a cold front, and that really is why the storm didn't drift south or north and it stayed focused in Nelson County. We're supposed to move forward when I push this one out, and maybe it eventually will. I don't know. Do I have to point at the computer, probably?
No, you should go now.
There we are. Okay, so this is not too much different, but just kind of showing you how much rain was right in this area along the spine of the Blue Ridge, and that it tracked from east to west. And this picture is a sort of centered on Nelson County, and what it's showing you basically is the topography of Nelson goes from below 400 feet here at the James River up to near 2,000 in the central part of the county with very steep slopes, and then goes up to over 4,000 feet over here. So you have this dramatic escarpment on the west side of Nelson, which is the east face of the Blue Ridge. And the other thing you see here is two different rock types, which we'll talk about later. They're very similar rocks, but they're slightly different. So then we go to this picture, and there's a lot of stuff said here. They didn't say that we were going to have a large amount of rain, because there's no real intense vortex going on. But this tells you the storm did not stall. And this was really first studied by Swartz right after Camille. And they studied that low pressure, and you can see these X's are 1-hour intervals. So that thing just keeps on moving. So Camille, the low pressure center, didn't stall. The cold front was stalled to the north of us, but the actual low pressure kept moving along to the south of where we had this intense rain. And consequently, we have documented 31 inches of rain in a 8-hour window, and that may even be less, maybe 6 hours, where there's 5 or 6 hours where there's intense rain. So you have over 3 to 4 inches of rain per hour falling at this event. So this is work from Jeff Halverson. I'm trying to give him credit here because he's the guru. So what he's saying is we have all these factors going on here. We have the Blue Ridge. We have really intensely heavy moisture-laden air available that the low-pressure system is pushing toward the Blue Ridge. And then this vortex starts at the rampart of the Blue Ridge and goes up in the air and starts a thunderstorm cell, and it moves off. And this helps this jet stream up here helps this vortex have energy to pull this moisture up through it. So all this is going on at the same time during the night. This slide's a little difficult at first to look at, but it's not. It really tells a fantastic story. You've got two radar centers, one in Pittsburgh and one in Washington, and they're a long ways away from us, 100 miles here. And Pittsburgh is 160 miles to the nearest edge of the storm. So they're a long ways away. So all that radar is seeing is the very tops of these tall, tall thunderstorm cells. That's all it's picking up. So from This darker color is Pittsburgh. So from Pittsburgh, all of these little dark spots are tops of thunderstorm cells that it's seeing. And there and there. Washington, D.C. being a little closer, it's seeing all this hashed area as thunderstorm cells. So now, if you start thinking about it, well, okay, this is 8 o'clock. This is somewhere in between. This is 11 o'clock. Why hadn't this moved? Well, these thunderstorms, they're moving, but the area of intense thunderstorm cells is still staying in the same place all night long. So how that happens is you have this intense moisture coming in, rising in these vortex things that are at the east face of the Blue Ridge, and then drifting with the energy from the jet stream to the east. And as they drift to the east, they start they trigger this rainfall. And 5 minutes after they rise up there, all of a sudden you start having rainfall. 10 minutes in it, you have real intense rainfall. And look where we are. We're over central Nelson County. Then, as you get on out to the eastern part of Nelson County, that real tall thunderstorm cell dissipates. So it doesn't have a tall thunderstorm cell, and there are no clouds up in the air above it. So, guess what? Another one forms behind it, does the same thing. Another one forms behind that, does the same thing. Then, all of a sudden, guess where all the rain, the intense rain, keeps falling in the same place? One cloud after the other drifts over. And here you're seeing, the radar saw the tops of this cell, but as you get out to the east, it's not seeing it anymore. So that's why we had so much rain in one spot. It didn't drift north or south because the cold front had it kind of locked in place against the mountains. And the mountains helped this stuff rise and drift off and drift off. So this happened all night long. And where's the maximum rainfall? Right here, 10 minutes after these things form at the Blue Ridge. So that's why we had so much rain. What does all that much rain produce? Well, here's the Blue Ridge, the eastern face, you know, where the cells would form. And this is 10 minutes out in the cell forming, dumping rain. And all of these red lines you see in here are debris flows from landslides that occurred, a few over here, but the vast majority of them are all right in here. Just for reference, Lovingston's about here. This is Davis Creek. This would be, I think this is Freshwater Cove. This is Hat Creek, this is Hat Creek here, and this is Cub Creek. This is Nellie's Ford area up here. The Rockfish River, the Tie River, the Piney River, the James River down here. So Lovingston is right in this area, and all these landslides occur just to the west of Lovingston. So Ann has put this together. This is a little busy, but you can figure it out pretty easily. This blue area down here are your flatter ground, lower elevations. The greens pick up a little more steeper ground, and then these purples up here are your real intense high elevation stuff. And so I think actually Jeff did this first, and I don't have his or Ann's name on this slide, but I do. Here it is. The reason my name's on there is because I helped them with some of this rainfall data and figuring out exactly where these points occurred. All of these little plus symbols, you see they're individual plus symbols. Every one of those is an individual landslide up on this side of a hill someplace. And then they coalesce and form a debris flow that goes down the hillside and through the stream valleys below. So what you're seeing is over here on the high hills, we had a few landslides, but the vast majority of them are in here. And the intense rain is here and here and here. Now, a couple of fallacies in this map are that we don't have anything to record rainfall in this area with. There was no container left. There is a container up in Freshwater Cove that I learned about that we added to this, and that's why these contours are increased here. The other thing that's noticeable on this map is down here we have intense rain as much as almost we have here. and almost as much as we have in there, but we don't have any landslides. And part of that is the terrain down here is not as steep. So you can't have a landslide if the land isn't steep enough to have a slide. So how these things start? Well, we have this loose rock soil and rock rubble, and the roots are going down into that. And then we have these joints in the rock that go down like this, sometimes right across the face of the slope like this. And these things would occur right up in this area. And where this occurs is right in this point, this magic point right here. You're going up the slope and you get up near the top and it just gets real steep and then it starts to curve back. That's where the soil broke loose all the way down to bedrock. And then below that, you would have a debris flow. And then down at the bottom, you'd have a debris fan or a run out of material, debris avalanche. You get different names for this stuff, but that's how these things kind of generate. Now, this image is showing you a couple of different types of landslides. This is real common. These are chutes. Each little valley, you have this breakout to rock up here, maybe in here, and then this thing is just a... it's just an avalanche going down that valley, taking all the trees away and everything. Then we have over here, this for those who know where this is near Mendus. These are slab slides. I've kind of coined that term. But the whole side of the mountain slid away. And it has a little bit to do with the geology, and something to do with the joints in the rocks. But further study is needed to... here before we could, the geologist that I'm talking to, really understand why more of these didn't occur around through Nelson County. But they're far more of these than they are of these. So when you go up some of these valleys, sometimes you'll have a chute slide, but then off to one side, the whole side of the hill coming into that valley will slide away. And that, we know, is caused by these joints. Remember those joints that I showed you in the earlier picture in the cartoon? Well, that's these little dark areas right here that you can see. And what you do if you walk up that rock face, you have to step up 6 or 8 inches to get up onto the next terrain. So they broke loose on that vertical joint that runs vertically into the ground and slid away on the lower side, and then that made things above it less stable, and then the whole hillside slid away. So if you get this joint pattern on one of these hillsides, this will occur. Here you can see that the joints are still in there, right? In these, all these little dark things are like little step-ups, and that causes more of a, you know, kind of a slab slide within a chute in that environment. Now, once this stuff goes off down the hillside, all this rock rubble, as soon as the steepness goes away, it starts to drop out of suspension. And you have these huge rock piles that are, if your car or house or barn happened to be in the path of where these things occur, it doesn't stand a chance. And people who lived near the bottom of these slopes that got in these rock avalanches, they were mowed down and there was major loss of life. Not here in this location. I know where this is, and this house and the one over here and the one in the background there, they survived and the people were fine, but there were a lot of cars and barns lost in this valley. Further down the slope, the rocks are gone. They're kind of fallen out up here in these areas where it first starts to get a little less steep, and then but on down here, liquefied soil has brought all these trees and brought them down, and the first obstacle they get into, they pile up, and then you have these mounds of trees. Some people call them hummocks and different things, but in a lot of parts of the county, these big wads mowed people's houses down with the people in them in the darkness of night with no warning. They didn't know it, they heard it, and then it was too late. So that's the mechanics of how this stuff happens. Further downstream, the trees have dropped out where they could, but you get sand deposits, massive sand deposits. Sand deposits like this occur when the water starts to slow down, and then it can fall out of suspension. And some places the water's already gouged out a major hole, and you fill it back up with sand later. But in this case, it's just a big, thick, you know, that's 8 to 10 foot of sand. In this environment here, the hole was gouged out, and an entire van trailer, probably from an 18-wheeler, it gone over in the hole, and then sand comes in and covers it back up again. So that's a lot of sand. And you can see it's kind of chaotic because it's just wherever the water went as the water started to recede. But the water here was probably, you know, 6 or 8 feet above the level of this trailer. A couple of these were lost off of 29 at Woods Mill, which is, if you know the area, where we have an historical marker there at the Nelson Wayside. It's where the two curved bridges exist as you first get into Nelson County on 29 going south. So now, this is the program where I'm going to let you watch something that we created earlier with the Historical Society that uses aerial photography. And what's happening here is we have pictures that we gathered from 1967, and then we have pictures we got from VDOT immediately after Camille in 1969. So this is a comparison of what it looked like before and after. One of the things that you need to remember while you're watching this is it looks like there's a lot of trees in the 69 pictures, but you got to remember the 69 photos were taken in August with leaves all over the trees. The 1967 photographs were taken in March when you could see through the trees because the leaves were not on them. So what you're going to see is it looks like there's nothing there, but there's trees in there that just don't have any leaves on them. So this is going to give you an example of what it looked like along 29 between Woods Mill and Lovingston along Muddy Creek, and it's going to give you a picture of what some of the situation was up at Tyro. This aerial view looks down on Highway 29 about a mile north of Lovingston. North is to the top of the image. The drainage from the broad valley on the right is the headwaters of Muddy Creek. The creek crosses under Highway 29 in a box culvert and joins the smaller stream that parallels Highway 29. The northbound lane is on the right and is slightly elevated relative to the valley. This valley is known as Eads Hollow. The red highlight in this image accents the classic bifurcated drainage pattern of Eads Hollow. The basin has landslide failures with debris runout in every primary ravine. Eads Hollow is currently home to Virginia Distillery. In 1969, the elevated lane of Highway 29 acted as a dam, and after the box culvert clogged, the valley quickly filled with water and a massive volume of sediment. Flow coming down the valley turned left and crossed where the roadway was in a lower elevation. This placed several homes in jeopardy. The image on the left was taken in 1967, and the image on the right in 1969. There are three houses in the left image that are not there in the right image. The circles in the order that they appear are the homes of the Bibb family, the Taylor family, and the French family. A total of 5 lives were lost in these 3 homes. To get a perspective as to the volume of sediment that was deposited, let's look closer at a home that was damaged but survived. Here is a picture of the Thompson home prior to Camille. Next is a picture of the Thompson home a few days after Camille. Notice the sediment covers the lower level and the water flow backs south toward Lovingston to cross Highway 29. A few days later, crews have opened the culvert and started to dig a channel for the creek. From here, we will fly north while you compare 1967 to the 1969 image on the right. Note the large fan-shaped deposit of sediments and debris on the left or west side of 29. This material came from landslide in two long valleys off of Woods Mountain. Notice the height of debris in the foreground. The massive volume of material pushed out into the floodplain of Muddy Creek, where it filled the channel, forcing the flow in Muddy Creek to cut and erode Highway 29. This view, looking back south along Highway 29, shows how Muddy Creek flow cut Highway 29. The red highlight shows the two valleys with landslide failures on Woods Mountain and the debris runout that encroached on Highway 29, causing the road embankment erosion. From here, we will fly north again while you compare 1967 to 1969. We have stopped our flight approximately over the intersection of Highway 29 and Stage Bridge Road. On the left of Highway 29 is a trailer park. Look closely and you will see the trailers are in different locations. The trailers that were roughly directly opposite the road intersection have moved downstream a bit. And a trailer that was across on the west side or left side of Muddy Creek is not there. This trailer is now against the brick house on the opposite side of Muddy Creek. In this image, we see the same trailer lodged up behind the brick house. Other trailers that were in the park have floated and come to rest off of their foundations. The valley on the west or left side of Muddy Creek has had significant flow, as evident by the jumbled cars mixed with debris. This image, looking west, shows the brick house and the small valley in the background. Note the small black dot at the edge of the creek. That dot is a car. This car washed from the Fortune family home and nosed into Muddy Creek. Crews begin the task of making access in order to clean up debris. A look from the opposite side of the creek a few days later shows the house trailer has been moved from behind the brick home, but the Fortune's car is still in the creek bank. In this location, residents had extensive property damage, but luckily no lives were lost. Let's take a moment and study the 1969 image in closer detail. So here are the credits for this, and while they're playing, I'll just, you know, we're going to go up to Tyro now and show you what happened up there. This aerial view, looking west at the Silver Creek packing shed and the remains of 56, is the backdrop for one of many stories that the Historical Society can share using gathered, donated, and saved data. This photograph was shot at least 12 hours after the rain stopped. The main channel of the Tie River is out of view along the right and lower margins of this image. Tyro is a spread-out community with a sparse collection of buildings. Highway 56 comes down the valley, entering the image on the right.
runs between the post office and the packing shed and runs in front of Austin Fitzgerald's store in the lower left. During the night, Ty River eroded its bank and cut its way out of its channel behind the post office. Highway 56 is not visible in the middle of the image because it is an active stream. A significant portion of the stream's flow was running down Highway 56. The valley floor widens considerably in the Tyro area. As water receded, braided channels could be seen in many places. We will start to the right of this image and take a closer look at a few scenes. Our view as we traverse will be going downstream, which is in the top of the image. In our 1967 image, we can see a house that is not present in the 1969 image. This was the home of Charles and Flossie Staten and their youngest daughter, Linda. The floodplain can be a vulnerable location, and during the night, their home was swept away. Let us begin to fly downstream while you compare the 1967 to the 1969 image.
This is the old channel, and the water's running
out. The first crew of rescue workers from outside the area did not reach Tyro until the afternoon of day one. Sheriff Whitehead was on a Marine helicopter that arrived in the afternoon as the water was receding and found locals gathered at Austin Fitzgerald's store to share information and plan searches. Currents were still strong, and getting from side to side often required crossing deep, swift water. As the helicopter arrives, Austin Fitzgerald Jr. waves as they prepare to land on a dry spot across from the store. Austin and several others wade the channel to talk with the helicopter crew. In the background, the home of John Henry and Francis Fitzgerald can be seen, damaged but still standing. They survived the night after climbing into the attic with their two-month-old son. They sat on rafters above the sheetrock all night and climbed down after daybreak. It was midday before they could get through the surrounding waters to safety, dry ground and dry clothes. Residents and the rescue crew shared information. Possibly they knew of another house upstream that was stripped from its foundation, where the Zirkle family of four was missing. Armed with more knowledge of those who survived and those who were missing, the Marine crew quickly prepared for departure. A couple of days later, the waters having receded even more, the helicopters continued their missions, gradually supported by local vehicles. A year later, a survey identifies high water marks and documents that waters rose to the standard project flood water level shown on this grade rod. This level is 3.5 feet above the front porch of Austin Fitzgerald's store. Inside the store, water got to roughly 3 feet deep. Water flowed through the lower end of Tyro, migrating between the homes and out into the broad valley downstream, before wreaking havoc on Massey's Mill, a more densely populated community situated in another narrow section of the valley. Let's spend a minute or so together and look at 1969 in closer detail. Thank you.
So we have lots of these photographs that I was just showing you, and our hope is to tell some more stories around the county over time, but it takes time and effort to put this together, and I need stories. So if you know of stories and I can find the photographs, maybe we can work together on those things. This is a different part of the county here. This is the community of Bryant. Bryant is along the west side on along Highway 151. If those who go down 151, if you go past the road that leads you up to Wintergreen, you go up over what everybody knows is the curvy mountain where you meet your taillights, Brent's Gap. When you go up over that mountain, this community here is about 2 or 3 miles further south on that main road, 151. I happened to go up here that morning with my father. Family that was lost lived up this direction, up this creek here, actually. They washed through here and on out into Hat Creek and down. That's what it looks like in 67. You can see Hat Creek comes down, winds around by the road, and goes on out. And all this is active cropland and field. Well, the next morning, that's what it looks like. And this valley here took 4 people to their death. During the night, I came here with my father, and there was probably a couple of feet of water in the, up on the road right here, and we couldn't go up any further this way. If you just do the math and look, that valley's 700 feet wide right there. I measured it, and so that means that out here in the center of the valley, there had to be 23 feet of water when you look at the elevation. So this little bitty stream that you can walk through, it doesn't get over your ankles, had 23 feet of water in it that night. 20 to 23 feet. So it's kind of interesting. If you look at it from a little different angle, what we're going to do is go way down here and look at it from the south, kind of at a low angle. And you can see the same area, the center of town, the creek comes up by there and then goes on out. But when you look at this image, every stream is filled with red mud. And water was way up on top of this road over here that night, so the red mud didn't settle out as deep everywhere, but it's just an awkward night. Another vulnerable area is at Lane Ford Bridge, which is where Mac's store is, further south on 151. This road is a fill all the way out to the bridge deck, and then a fill across to the other side. So there's a road embankment that goes across the valley. And that night, this couldn't handle all the water where the channel of the river goes under the bridge there. It couldn't begin to handle the water. So the water was backing up and became quite deep here above the road, backing water up, way up past where Massey Saunders lives. And It just slowly rose, and we stood there at this store and watched. I guess that store is right in here, but we watched as this water rose higher and higher and came closer and closer to the store. And the deck, water was slamming against the deck, and the water started easing up over top of the road on this side of the deck and that side because maybe it's a few inches lower in elevation. And then as it went over the back side of the road embankment in this area and in that area, it started to cut away the dirt on the backside, and then it started to undermine the asphalt, and it took about 10 minutes or so, and it had completely eaten the asphalt away, and it was starting to eat all the dirt embankment away. And once it ate that down, it just went like this. And the next morning, you've got 150, 200 foot of road gone on either side of the bridge deck, which survived. This is on the south side toward Piney River. This is a road back to Mass's Mill, and you can see the water was going over top of the rails. We watched all that debris get caught up in that night, and then we could see the erosion over there and here. So when that dam, basically a dam, breached, it wreaked havoc on the people downstream, and the family that lived in this house. This house stood over here on a foundation and was actually up, it was a two-story building. You can see that from the porch, the edges of the porch roof that was over the first floor. And there was a family that lived in the apartment in the basement, and they broke through and broke in the apartment and went upstairs and were standing up in the corner of this house with water up to here, holding their four young children up in their arms like this, trying to keep them up on furniture and above ground. While the house collapsed, the bottom floor, the first floor collapsed, and this floated up against these trees, or else it would have been destroyed as well. So this, I call this in Camille, Hazard A. Let's just call it A for no other reason. These people, and the ones in Tyro for the most part, and the ones in Masses Mill, they died of drowning. They washed out in the water. It was pretty deep water. There weren't a tremendous number of landslides in this area, so we had a lot of death by drowning here. And that's what I'll just call type A. Now I'm going to jump over to type B, and this gets back to our landslides. So if you have a house in here, which there was a house right there and people in it, you're going to get bulldozed down. You're not going to have floodwaters up around your house. You're going to have logs and rocks and debris. And this house right here experienced that. The picture of that house is probably the one of the most commonly photographed pictures during Camille. It's on the front cover of our book back there as well. That's what it looks like. A few days ago, saw somebody I knew from my early childhood who was living in this house the night of Camille. And his son was in one of these beds. They had three children, I think, at the time, and all three of them were in here. The parents were in this room under this ceiling right here that got ripped away. They went out of their room back into a hall that brings you around to this room. The hallway leads down the backside. This is actually a T-shaped house, and that back wing survived. But this entire half of the house was completely ripped away, and the water was up to here downstairs, so they couldn't go out and up, which is what I thought they had done to survive. They actually huddled up here all night long. So after the house ripped away, and many of you may know this and some may not, but that night we had intense lightning. I mean, repeated, like a strobe light going off. It was just intense lightning. So imagine you're up here huddling with your three small children and watching all this go by in front of you in strobe light sort of environments. And the guy said it was intense. And I talked to he and his daughter. They're both still alive. The mother just recently died. Their last name is Coffee. Anyway, so now I'm going to go back and try to pick up on that A and B thing again. And what I've done here is I helped Seville Review publish this map. With my help, they got these communities and numbers of death in each community tidied up a little bit from what they had been able to figure out. And so anyhow, what shows here is like there's 22 people that died in Masses Mill, 7 in Tyro, 2 in Cub Creek area, 1 off of 29 at Rucker's Run, 7 in Norwood. And then what I've done here recently is I've added a circle. And what that circle is doing is telling you where I'm telling you most of the people died from being bulldozed over. Blunt force trauma should have been on their death certificate. These people out here mostly died of drowning. Some may have been beat up, but they definitely were in water. The people inside this circle were not really buried in water. They may have had some exposure to water, but probably few of them had water in their lungs. So 65% of the deaths, there's 124 souls, some visiting, some traveling through from Nelson and residents of Nelson, make that total. But anyway, 65% of them died from type B or blunt force trauma sort of death. So now I'm going to that general view of Nelson County again with the James River and the Rockfish River over here and the Ty and the Piney over here. So this is that general view. So I used Ann's work again, and I'm just trying to show you where these communities are and how many landslides we had. And Ann has been counting up every one of these little places where there's just a rip out all the way down to rock, and she can see it in photographs and other data that she's looking at. And so in that area right there in southern Albemarle County, around into northern western Nelson and a little bit over in Amherst, 5,600 landslides and counting. That's a big number. Not 1,000, not 2,000, 5,600 and counting. Okay, so in the past, what Ann and others like her would do is study landslides, looking at orthophotos and air photos. And this is a photograph taken from 69, and then in 60 and 98, you know, 40 years later, it's starting to look like this, and you can barely make out where the trees have not come back and where the landslide went through. But newer studies have come up with a different way of looking through that so that we can study these landslides. And it's called LIDAR. And basically, they take a laser and shine it at the ground and let it reflect back up, and they measure the time it takes to do that. And it can, you can then filter that data and eliminate reflections from vegetation, tree trunks, cars, buildings, all that can pretty much be eliminated, and you know when you get to solid ground. So then when you filter that data, you get a LIDAR image, and that LIDAR image tells you a lot about what you can't see through the trees. Here's a case where we have a valley running down this direction. This is the top of a ridge. These are the dense trees on the north side of the ridge. These are the lighter trees with the sun against them on the south side. When these pictures are taken, sometimes they take it at a low sun angle, so you kind of get that dark light thing, and that's the top of a ridge, and that's the top of a ridge. This is a valley coming up, and the road driveway comes up and around to this house, and you see a funny-looking little thing right here, but you don't know what that is. Well, if you look at LIDAR, all of a sudden, this valley that's coming down over here has these scarps on this side of the hill that you couldn't even see in that image. You can't see it. But in LIDAR, you know a landslide occurred here. You know this is a head scarp here, and this is where all that debris ran down the valley. You know in this little valley there was a landslide on this one side right there. And you can see the road driveway around to where the man built his house. And these other trails might be old logging roads or something like that that people use to get timber out and things. So on this, we have a debris slide. We have a debris flow. We have head scarps like that little guy, probably these guys. And some are more obvious and less obvious. And then we have this landslide that occurred over here that you didn't hardly see in the old data. I mean, regular air photos just don't show you this stuff. For example, in this picture, this is the top of a ridge here, and a ridge runs down, and a ridge runs down there. But this is a hollow or a ravine coming uphill toward this hilltop. And up in the top of this thing, there are landslides in all these little pockets that you can map out. And then once those landslides coalesce into a debris flow, they come down here and they run out. And so what this is showing you is a landslide debris fan at the bottom of a steep ravine, and all that debris is piled up in that field there. And in this location, these boulders probably came out of here. And this is high enough up in the woods where nobody went there and reclaimed the land and pushed the rocks out of the way. If you, in, you know, a lot of places, the farmers, the state and the federal government helped the farmers and people in Nelson County by clearing the fields of the rocks, trees, and debris, so they could go back to productive farming. Well, that all said, up here, they probably, this was up in a higher area, and none of that was done. And if you have those areas that still remain today, you know you had a landslide there because you can see in the LIDAR data a debris field, and you can see where it came from. So that's why our LIDAR helps us study these areas. So here, what happens now is we want to figure out, well, why, where do we have landslides and why do they occur in some areas and not other areas? And a lot of it has to do with slope. So if your slope gets up to 25 degrees or higher, you can have a landslide. And if you have an excess of 6 to 10 inches of rain in a 24-hour period, oftentimes that rain will trigger a landslide. But to start with, I'm sorry about these dots here. That had to do with a field trip that I led, but that's not what we're studying here. What I'm trying to tell you is, if you take Nelson County, and this is that same sort of general image with the Rockfish River over there and Nellie's Fords in here and Beech Grove, Wintergreen's up here, Tyro area over here, 151. So you can kind of tell where you are with 29 running through here. Woods Mill is there. So within that geographic area of Nelson County, all of this red stuff is slopes greater than 25 degrees. And there's a lot of geographic area. If you just measure how many square miles, it's 34 square miles in central Nelson County with slopes over 25 degrees. So there are a lot of places where landslides could occur. If you go down here where we had a fair bit of rain, we don't have very many slopes that high. So it's, you can have a lot of rain and not have landslides. But look where the landslides occur and how they match up to where we have steep slopes. These green things are landslides, and that red means there's a greater than 25-degree slope. So that's pretty concrete evidence that landslides need 25-degree slopes. You can see that we have some really steep slopes over here, but not many landslides. There are reasons for that. Okay, so now what we've done here is we have gone a little different route here. We're comparing how many landslides per square mile, if you want, or whatever the number is there. I guess it is in square miles. That's the reddish-looking color. So the redder it is, the more landslides you have. Green, no landslides. Yellowish, starting to go red, you got some landslides, a few landslides here. So in this central area, you've got a lot of landslides right here, and we've got high rainfall here, high rainfall here. So these are contour lines, and toward the center of this is the highest recorded number we have, 31. And then up here, we have a 31 and a 27 right next to each other. In here, this should have had a plus sign on. That means over 14 inches. This is also over 11, but we don't have any data in here. Davis Creek area is in here, and everything washed away. There's nothing left, no container left to measure anything with. We also have 27 inches right north of Lovingston right there. So you can see that the water, the amount of rain and the landslides have a correlation, but you see a lot of rain over here and not that many landslides, and a lot more here. And we think we know some facts about that. So we go to a geologic map, and you can see, again, you've kind of got one type of rock in here and another type over here. And then you got another type that's in the middle in this blue that separates the two, and that's the Rockfish Valley fault zone. So these rocks are laying separated from those by some rocks that are kind of jumbled up in the fault zone. And we are looking at a lot of similarities between these rocks, but there's some differences in them as well. This is an amphibolite facies rock, and the next one is a granulite facies rock. Basically, they're very similar. This has some different minerals and is of a higher metamorphic grade, and it's been altered quite a bit differently than the rocks to the west. And we think that has a relationship to why we have more land. We have similar rainfall amounts in the two areas, but we have more landslides in this one than in that one. I'm supposed to be going to the next slide, but I'm not sure we did yet. Okay, so then we put the landslides on that map, and you can see what I was talking about is true. This type of rock has got more landslides, and this has fewer. So then it comes to one of my favorite slides. So you heard all the stuff I said about the danger zones and how these rocks come down out of the hills. If you built your house, do you think this guy did a good job of picking the location? Well, the subtle differences in elevation mean a lot. And that house being 2 or 3 feet higher in elevation at that house site meant this landslide came down and split and went right around his house. So I asked the question at the top, is your house in the right location? It's important. Subtle difference in elevation and knowing that you're near one of these areas or not. See, this guy didn't build over here near this valley. He built on a little rise between that valley and that valley. Again, he picked a good spot. A lot of the older homes in Nelson County survived, and the post-World War II homes are the ones that were the most commonly damaged. The old people got there first. All right, so here's some questions. 124 people killed, 5 hours, 1% of the total population of the county. That's what we know. What's being done? Well, the National Weather Service, and I went down and toured their office in Blacksburg, and it's true. They've got a lot of high energy, high-end stuff down there that they're working with to predict this stuff. And they have actually was involved in conversations they had about early warnings that come, and they've not only in just telling you that you're going to have a lot of rain, they're also telling you when they see enough rain to cause landslides. And so in that area, they'll come out and say landslides have potential in these counties. And that's because they see enough rain and they know those counties have steep enough slopes. So that's being developed into what the National Weather Service is providing for you. And there's a lot of local funding. I mean, there's state zoning laws and federal zoning laws that keep you from building houses in floodplains. Residential buildings are not being built in floodplains, and that's a good thing, and that's something that we can do. Well, who benefits from these kind of actions? Mostly those living in flood-prone areas prone to flooding. And who got killed in those areas? A, the people in type A that drowned. So what happens? What are we going to do to protect those that might be killed by blunt force trauma? Because they're not going to die of drowning. Landslides need to be thought about as a hazard. So it's a beautiful valley. Looks like a good place to build my home or not. That's my question. So right now today, the Department of Mines and Minerals and Energy, and particularly the Geology and Mineral Resource Group, is actually got some budget and some money to start studying these landslides and learning more about where they occur and why they occur to try to get help out there. But they have very limited budget. And I also think that some zoning, but zoning for landslide debris, that might be a hard sell, because who wants to be told that, no, you can't build there at the base of this mountain? People don't like that. I think that's been tried in North Carolina quite a bit. And I think what happened is, the local governments found out that there was pushback. Developers and real estate people especially, but also some people that just wanted to build there and they weren't worried about that hazard. So there is it's a little bit of a hard sell, but awareness and education, I think, is the way to go and to make people aware of that. I mean, if I were getting ready to build a house and I found out that this particular land was in an area that could be affected by a landslide, I would rather find that out before I drill my well and started the foundation. In particular, I'd like to find that out maybe even before I bought that piece of property. So that's what I mean by education and awareness, and I think it's important to share this information and to let people that are moving to a community know about what could happen, what might happen. So could it happen again? According to the meteorologist I'm talking to, yes. There have been a number of pretty severe rain events. As a matter of fact, here about 5 or 6 years ago, I had a rain event at my house, and it happened over about a 1 square mile area. We had 6 inches of rain in 1 hour right down there in southern Nelson County. And two other people measured it as well. That's a lot of rain. And if that happened in the right mountainous area, that would cause landslides just in itself. So anyway, thank you for helping me share that last bit of information to any and all that you know that would like to hear about it. And that concludes my program. Thank you.
We have somebody over here with a mic, and so we're you're open to questions, correct?
Yes, sir.
What about sinkholes in Lovingston?
Sinkholes in Lovingston.
Right. There's a button. Multiple sinkholes in Lovingston, all occurring on approximately during the same month, a couple summers ago.
Can you tell me where?
Next to the courthouse and further on down towards the nursing home. Multiple sinkholes.
Okay. As a geologist, I'll tell you that's the wrong environment for sinkholes to form. Classic sinkholes form in limestone environments, and that is not limestone. Given the fact that it's in an urban area, I would say those sinkholes most likely are probably related to past building construction patterns and buried culverts or buried conduits for water, stormwater to go. And when that drains by, it erodes the ground.
Right. It's very close to a culvert.
Right. So that has to do with man's construction. And you solve that by doing a lot of things. For example, there are culverts that have washed out on VDOT's roads in a lot of areas, and years ago they put a culvert in and they cover it with everything, any and every rock. Oftentimes, just because it was hard to get it compacted around the culvert pipe, they just put big stone up under there. And I've been to a class recently where VDOT's changed their plan, and they don't allow that anymore. They don't want you to put large rocks because large rocks have large voids and allow water to migrate past. And water migrates past, it a lot of times erodes the dirt next to the big rocks with voids, and then you get these collapses. So now VDOT says you have to put all these culverts in and pack around them with a rock type that has a bunch of fine material in it so that the water can't use those voids to travel through real fast. And it's 21A's is what they like to put around culverts nowadays. And that would address those problems, wouldn't have happened had the right construction procedures been used.
Dick, I lived in Amherst, and I remember your dad quite well. I knew him. The volunteer effort that he helped coordinate, there were many of us a part of that with the American Red Cross starting almost the day after. I have many vivid, vivid memories, of which some I'd like to forget, but your dad was a very strong force in putting it all together. The Mennonites, probably one of the strongest forces in bringing Nelson County back. This has been extremely interesting information. And I remember the night that it rained. I lived in a tin roof right on 29 in Amherst. That was before the bypass. And there was lightning and the rain on that tin roof. My children were upstairs, came downstairs, and it was just in Amherst. And I couldn't imagine what it must have been like around Davis Creek in that area. But your dad did a phenomenal job of organizing and staying with it for a long, long time. And thank I you. Commend him and you as well.
Well, I had small part. I think Fred had a...
I want to bring up one thing. A lot of people are not going to know it, but back in the early part of last century, a lot of your farmers put in what's called blind ditches to drain swampy areas, and sometimes in the later years they would fail. Mm-hmm.
And also,
where was that house that the stream split, went around both sides?
That's you go up East Branch and you get up there to where Schaefer's Hollow Road goes off. Do you know where that is? It's up there where you turn left, go up to Ed Ely's house. If you go straight across down in there, and that house burned down, and they rebuilt another one on the same place. It was a Campbell farm.
Yes, we've been hearing that the hurricanes are now being formed with greater energy and more frequency, perhaps. Do you think this will have an implication for the rainfall and events such as this into the future?
I've heard Jeff speak about that, and he does think that everything you just said is true, and he doesn't attribute this. This is kind of a special sort of hurricane. This is a case where the hurricane came through and mined up the moisture that was there on the ground, and it made use of that cold front to wreak havoc. The hurricane itself had energy in it, but it didn't have enough to cause all this without having those other things available. So when you get into these environments where you have some factors coming together that can get locked into terrain, you have these terrain controlled cell environments, and you get intense rain for just real intense rain for short periods of time. And yes, they have occurred. We've had in 10, 12 hours, we had 12, 13 inches of rain down here in Nelson County associated with Isabel, and we had another event where it was just an afternoon thunderstorm. I think part of what you're talking about is kind of what we saw this past summer when we had these hurricanes come in and just kind of sit there along the Gulf Coast because the energy wasn't there to drive them on through, and then it just mined the moisture that was there in that area, and what they just had rain for 3 or 4 days straight all in the same area. That's kind of unusual. I don't remember hurricanes doing that when I was young.
And a follow-up question, do you think, you know, with the gyrations of the jet stream that currently they're talking about jet streams dropping farther south because of the higher energy in the North Pole. I could see possibly that could lead to more events like this.
Yes, and that's exactly the language Jeff was using. The jet stream is further south. It's making these big loop arcs that drop down further south, and that's causing these intense weather patterns, if you want to call them that.
You mentioned at lunch that your dad had been several generations, his family, in Nelson County, and your mom was the counselor at the high school. Did you have any of your, and I know you said you don't want to get too much into the depth of it because it's an emotional issue, but did any of your fellows from high school that you graduated with or people you knew in the high school, were they lost in the flood?
Yes. Yeah. Very much so. I had the pleasure of being pallbearer 2 days in a row, bearing families, not individuals, families. And one family, the girl graduated high school with me. And the other family, they were just below me and just above me in age. One of those families, the mother introduced my parents to each other. So it's not fun when you go out first thing in the morning and you start looking for the kids you played with yesterday. Not fun. So a lot of kids were lost in the high school. Davis Creek, the lady that's the president of the Historical Society right now, Debbie Harvey, she lived up the head of it, and she would say, you know, she was a little kid, you know, and I think she was probably 9 or 12, somewhere in that range, and she would get on the bus to come down. When they came down, they'd come all the way up there and pick her up at the head of the valley. And when they came down and got to 29, the bus was full. Well, when the schools opened back up, the bus was empty when it got to 29.
I came in late, so I don't know if you mentioned some of the things. Our farm is on Fortune's Cove, and the water came right down Fortune's Cove, but we were high up above Al Weed's winery, so that house wasn't touched at all. But what's interesting about Nelson County, you can ride around Nelson County now and you see many old barns, and I don't know if you mentioned that, that are not being taken down because people's lives were saved when they were hiding in the barns.
I don't know. I can't say where that happened.
But the barns are there. You can see them.
Yeah, I know. I just don't know. I don't know of locations where people migrated from their house to the barn for safety. Most of the time, the barn was in the lower elevation, and the house was on a little rise. But it depended.
But somehow it worked.
Yeah, I'd just like to know where that is. Do you know where it is, Fred?
No, I know where one is. It may have done it. It's a junction of Grape Lawn Drive and Rocky Road. Just before it comes out on 29, around from Woods Mill, there's an old barn below the, and that was the Johnny Wood place.
Yeah.
Curtis Matthews and his wife lived in the Johnny Wood house, but right. They went out of the rear back of the house and went up the mountain.
Well, they got out of the house and up on the ridge and walked over to the road and went up to his mother's house.
Right, uh-huh, that's right.
But that barn was...
I don't know of anybody. It's still there today.
I don't think that barn, if I remember right, the bottom 25% of that barn filled up with sand. They had to shovel it all out.
It's been used since the flood, really.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think it's the bottom part of it got filled up. But anyway, I talked to Curtis's son, David, and he told me that he sat up there at his grandmother's house that night and watched pieces of houses come floating down that creek. And this is right there above where I showed you that real thick sand with a guy standing beside it. That's right there at 29. And where he's talking about that barn is just upstream from there. And just up above that is where David was sitting there that night. And he watched as portions of houses came floating down that creek. And there was somebody on that house on the roof of it with a flashlight. And the flashlight would come at him and then it would disappear and come at him. And he said he could hear them yelling, but there was no way you could get to them. So those sort of stories are quite prevalent. I wish I knew where the barn was that somebody survived in. I do know that it... I know where a lot of barns are, but I don't know where any are that people spent the night in, is what I'm saying. So,
thank you very much, Dick. That's been fascinating.